My name's Matthew, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for having me. It's been really interesting coming to Reno. Vicki and Christy, thanks for just setting this up. I really think it's an honor to speak here. The interesting part is if one more person comes up to me and says, "You're the spiritual speaker," I'm going to run out the door, because I've thought a lot about that this weekend. I'm recovering from Catholic school also, and when you start putting that on me, I feel incredible guilt. But you know what? Every speaker I've heard has been the spiritual speaker, and I've been listening to get all their good stuff. But it really is an honor and a pleasure to be here. And I always like to say at the beginning of a pitch is that, you know, I come from a very loving and functional family. My parents were not alcoholics. And I always want to honor them because they're not with us anymore. However, there was alcoholism in my family. My uncle Ed used to come and ruin every Thanksgiving. Yeah, it is funny. I can remember he'd start drinking, and then all these fights would break out about Nixon. I was just a little kid, but I could see it was the drinking. And I just stopped going to my house for Thanksgiving because I didn't like to see that. I felt uncomfortable around it, and my mother would cry because it was her only brother. Her other brother had died of alcoholism. And my father would, you know, reevaluate his arguments all night long after my uncle stormed out. You know, just one of those things. And my brother, I'm the youngest of four, and the brother just above me, he's 7 years older than me. Neil is an alcoholic and has been since he was 14. So there was that alcoholism in my home. But my parents, really did the best for us. They sent us to a private school, and they had no money. And they sent us all to college, except for Neil, because he couldn't quite make it. He ended up getting his high school girlfriend pregnant and started his life as a functioning alcoholic, but he got sober, you know. And also, I should say, my grandfather, Neil, who my brother is named after, died of alcoholism in 1945, and Bill Wilson tried to help him personally. And I didn't know that until my father was dying, and he said, "My dad knew the leader of your club." Yeah. And I thought that was funny, too, because my dad didn't talk about his dad. You know, it was a bad memory. And my grandfather apparently was a investment banker in the 30s and a brilliant man. He could translate Latin. He went to Jesuit school like good Irish boys did. I'm Irish, so I belong here. And my dad, it was just a horrible thing. And I felt sad for my dad that two of his sons, particularly the one he named after his own father, when he finally came to terms with his father, turned out to be just like him. But my Uncle Ed, you know, I wouldn't go to Thanksgiving at our house after a while because I just couldn't stand it. And because of the drinking in my home with my brother, you know, it's funny, when you're 10 and 11 and you see this, you have very clear vision and you think, it's the drinking. And I would go to my brother, because I wasn't my parents, and he would sometimes listen to me, and he'd say, "It's not the drinking. You don't understand. You know how we say that? You don't understand?" And I think I kind of did. But when I was just about to leave for college, he got sober. He was living in his car. We did what was very popular at that time. It was called tough love. And we decided to kick him to the curb. You know, he'd gotten kicked out of his wife's house and the baby and all this stuff. And I remember one of the things he used to do is he would call my mother and say, "You know, Mom, I'm going to bring the baby over and I'm going to come visit you. And we're going to have Sunday dinner with you." And there was always an empty high chair and an empty two chairs for them. And my mother would cry and my father would swear. And I just wanted to kill him, because I looked at these beautiful people who were so kind and thought, how could he hurt these people? And when he got sober, he came to live with us. He actually lived in his car and he went to a group of people. I told somebody this the other night. My brother would share at an AA meeting because it was the only place he could go. It had hot coffee, you know. And he would share, and there was a guy, an old-timer, I think the old-timer in that group at that time had like 7 years, and as Neil would share, he would go, "Bullshit!" Every time my brother opened his mouth. And my brother had the wherewithal to finally ask that guy to sponsor him. And that guy went, "Oh, Christ," you know. And my brother was sober for 20 years, and he got exactly 20 hugs from his sponsor, only on his birthday. It wasn't one of those touchy-feely relationships. Anyway, so what I saw before I left for college when I wasn't a drinker, this goes right along with my title as spiritual speaker. I should talk about when I did try to drink in high school. My friends went out of town. This was my first drink, as I recall. I'm not sure. But my friend's parents went out of town, and these people had a beautiful home in Hermosa Beach with an ocean view. And I went to these little Catholic schools, so I had the same six friends all my life, you know, first grade all the way through. They're still my six closest friends. Or they are again, thanks to you. But I went to this house, and there was the six of us and no girls. And back then, when you're, you know, a sophomore in high school, that's a party. And they got a bottle of tequila, and I immediately felt tense. I was pretty tightly wound anyway. You know, Catholic school, the brothers drinking, I'm trying to please my parents. I got a lot out of the Al-Anon luncheon. Thank you, Nancy. But I just saw my friends doing this, and I wanted to be part of it. And so I got, they were doing shot glasses of tequila, and I'd never had tequila, and I took a shot, and I wasn't tightly wound anymore. I just went, whoa, and I relaxed. And I had another shot. And then I thought I was pretty entertaining, and wisdom came flowing from me. And so I got a glass and said, you know, let's just forget these little glasses. Put it in here. And we were, you know, nothing unusual was happening. We were drinking. The parents were gone. There were no girls. No one was going to get pregnant, and we weren't driving. So, but then I had a little too much, I guess. And I had to go to the bathroom, and this is where God first enters my story. As I sat down on the toilet, and the room started to spin, and this was a new experience for me. And the last thought I had before I blacked out was God would not make a body, because I'm a Catholic school kid, would not make a body that could defecate and vomit at the same time. I was wrong. And I lurched towards the sink, and I blacked out. And I'm sure it was a bloody mess in there, you know, but my friends, who should have been at the Al-Anon luncheon, apparently cleaned me up and put a blanket on me and a pillow under my head, and I woke up in my little makeshift room in the bathroom, you know. And I didn't know what had happened. I didn't remember. It slowly dawned on me the next day in high school, where you're not at all worried about your image. Walking down the halls of high school, I'm like, uh-oh. And I remembered, and I just felt terrible remorse because, look, I'm just like my brother. And then I went to have a good time, and I made a fool out of myself. So I didn't drink again in high school. I know some people say, oh, I got deathly ill and went right back at it. It wasn't the ill part. It was the family association and the not wanting to be an alcoholic. So I went off to college, and there was like this, somewhere between Los Angeles and Chico State, there's a little memory erasure part of I-5. And I forgot that I wasn't going to drink. I got there, and I hate to scare any parents who are sending their kids off to college, but in 1 week I did acid, cocaine, marijuana, and I drank a bunch of beer. And I loved it. And mostly I drank, you know. And I drank alcoholically immediately, you know. I drank to get loaded. I almost said something else, but I asked Vicki, you know, what does it mean to be the spiritual speaker? And she says, just don't say the F word, honey, you'll be fine. So I drank and I encountered in my first year of drinking in college that what is called a dry drunk. I didn't know it at the time, but I decided to stop because it was obvious after 6 months of debauchery that I was an alcoholic, and I'd come from this sort of background where drinking was the only problem in my youth you know, my happy family. And so I didn't go to AA or anything. Oh, I meant to say that. When my brother got sober and moved in with us, he would be lying in the bathtub reading the Big Book. And I just wanted to know, what is in that book? We tried everything. We pleaded with him. We begged him. There were tear-filled nights. There were fist fights. There was awful things. There was a baby. There was a poor teenage mother. There was tough love. And none of it got him sober, but there was this blue book that was just terribly, he dropped it in the bathtub a couple times, he underlined everything, and he had a dictionary, he kept looking through the dictionary, and my brother is brilliant. He's, everybody but me and my family has a genius like you, but I'm the youngest, but he was looking words up to know exactly what was in that book. Anyway, so I go off to college and I try to quit drinking halfway through my freshman year, and I became a dry drunk, and I didn't know that. What happened was the girl I was dating finally brought a six-pack of beer to my room and said, your friends bought this for you. Please drink it. And I was like, what are you talking about? She goes, you are such a jerk. And I'm like, no, I'm the nicest guy in the world, you know. But I was so uptight. Everything pissed me off. I was restless. I was irritable, and I was discontent. Like that, after just 6 months of drinking. So why fight progress? I just drank. You know, I went right back to it. And I went to Chico State, and you all know about Chico here in Reno. There was a lot of marijuana around, and I smoked it. But out of respect for the singleness of purpose of this group, I am an alcoholic. I crave alcohol. When I have a drink, I don't know where it's going to go. And when I want to stop, I can't. But I do like to bring up this marijuana thing because I had a degree in English. I graduated with honors. Well, it's Chico State, but I graduated with honors. I was one of the guys who made it all the way through. And I would smoke pot and read because I love to read. I love to read now. And you smoke pot and read, then I'd smoke pot and go to class, you know. And then I'd smoke pot and write a paper. And I remember years later, after college, my wife gave me a book called 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And if you haven't read it, read it. It's just a beautiful book. It's a very emotional, lovely book. It's a novel. And I would wake her up. You know, this is years later when I'm sober. And I'm waking her up going, God, and I'd read a part to her. And she'd go, I know, it's a beautiful book. That's why I gave it to you. And then I'm like, oh, God. And then I read the last page of this book. It's just amazing. And I woke her up and read the last page. And she said, I know. And we moved into a house later on that year. And I'm carrying this big file drawer. And there's a paper that I wrote in college on 100 Years of Solitude that's 10 pages long. And I didn't remember any of it. But I was told by a psychologist that it's called conditioned learning. If you're stoned when you read and write, then when you get stoned, you remember that. But because you've lost all that short-term memory, so if I smoke pot today, I could own this casino. I'd be brilliant. But as it is, all of my college is completely gone from my memory, and some things I'm grateful for. Anyway, I went to college. I ended up going to the East Coast to college, too. I went to UMass Amherst, which turns out is the Chico State of the East Coast. Lucky me. And then after that, I was playing music. And that's what I did. When my brother was drinking and there was this chaos in my life, my mother bought me a guitar. She was so cute. My mother was a very lovely, quiet, observant person. And she said, you don't get picked first for the team, do you, Matthew? I said, no, I don't. And she said, well, do you like to play an instrument? And I just loved guitar music. I always listened to it. I loved the Beatles. I loved Stones. I loved Segovia. I loved guitar music when I was very small. So I got a guitar, and I just played it all the time. I went in my room and played it because I couldn't make sense of all that chaos. And I loved music. So, you know, I played alcoholically or whatever. I was obsessive about it. I played 4 to 6 hours a day. And I had awful acne in high school. But I dated the head cheerleader because I could play the shit out of the guitar. Yeah. And all these jocks used to throw me against my locker and ask me why I was dating her. And I'd be like, I don't know, but I am. Anyway, I always liked that. So I went on tour with these rock bands is what I did with my great degree in literature, and I toured around, and because I didn't want to grow up and because I loved to play music, and I had some Class A opportunities, and I blew all of them. I played with a band that made several albums, and they asked me to leave in between albums. I'm not even on an album. I wrote one of the songs. I would miss the bus. I would be in one town, and I liked the people and the drinking so much, I thought, I'll just stay an extra day. And the bus would leave, and that's a bad thing to do to your band when you play lead guitar, and they're looking at that. There's like a microphone and a spotlight, and nobody's standing there, and I would show up to recording sessions drunk. And the reason I always try to say this is I loved music. This is what I wanted all my life, and I blew it. I drank myself out of the job no one else could drink themselves out of. I drank myself out of being a rock star, you know. My own bandmates would be like, dude, cool out, you know. I'm like, what do you mean? We're a rock band, you know. This is part of the life. I drank Wild Turkey. We used to call it the kickin' chicken. And we drank. But so my mother, when I was living on the East Coast, I was living in North Carolina playing with this band called the Connells, and we were having some success, and they asked me to leave. And my mother got cancer at that time and had gotten a very short amount of time to live. So I lied, and I told everybody that I came back to be around my mother. It was a lie. I came back because I burned all my bridges. But I look good if I'm coming home to take care of my mother. And I got a job at a restaurant, a Marie Callender's restaurant, and as a waiter. And I went back to, I had this apartment near the beach on Avenue A in South Catalina and Redondo, a real neat little area. And they quickly made me a manager because I was one of the few waiters who had a degree in literature with honors, and I went to some grad school, and they quickly made me a manager, and they had a bar there. And I had the keys. And I was a failed rock star. So I had all this, and this job was so beneath me, you know, managing the Marie Callender's, that I would go at night. It was on Pier Avenue in Hermosa Beach. Somebody here knows this Marie Callender's, and if you drank there, I don't remember you. But we went. I would close the thing at night and hang out with some of the waitresses and drink, and you know, hand out free liquor from the bar, and often be the only one there in the wee hours of the morning. And I would see the manager for the day shift driving down the street because all the windows faced the street. And I would run through the restaurant and slide across the kitchen and set the alarm and jump out into the parking lot, this vast parking lot with one car in it. And I would lie down on the floor of my car because he's not going to know I'm here, right? And he would drive up, park right next to me, look at my car, unset the alarm, and go in. And the bar is a mess, and I hadn't done the books, and, you know, so... Anyway, I started hooking up with these waitresses. I was a little more worldly, and I was the manager, and I slept with, you know, I was sexually irresponsible with as many people as I possibly could be. And this one waitress was, it may be crass to say this, particularly as the spiritual speaker, but when we were naked and making love, we liked each other a lot. But when we were dressed and sober, we hated each other. We just fought all the time. I never had a girlfriend that threw things at me, and this girlfriend threw things at me on a regular basis, if we weren't loaded. But when we were loaded, you know, it was a sexual relationship. Well, just before I get fired from Marie Callender's, she gets pregnant. I got her pregnant. And if you had lined up all the waitresses and said, which one would you like to get pregnant, I would say, not that one. Her, not her. And because she was this girl from Manhattan Beach, you know, and I don't know if you're familiar with that area, but she didn't get the right red convertible when she turned 16 and all that kind of stuff and just very spoiled. But she was the one. And I got fired. And I remember I walked across the street because I had my car taken away for a DUI. And then across the street from Marie Callender's is a rehabilitation center for retarded kids and autistic, well, adults. And they're trying to train them to work, live on their own, right? So I walk up to the bus stop wearing my Marie Callender's badge and my thin tie, and I've been up for a couple of days, and I smell bad, and I'm crying because I just got fired from this job that was beneath me, and I have an 18-year-old girl who's pregnant, and I'm 29 years old. So things aren't good. And I walk up to the bus stop, and there's all these autistic and retarded kids, and I'm used to that. I take the bus with them, and I turn around and I'm waiting for the bus, and the bus cannot come fast enough, you know. So I stepped off the curb to look to see where the bus was, and 10 autistic people said, "Don't stand in the street! Don't stand in the street!" And I thought, retarded people are teaching me how to wait for a bus. And all this other stuff. And it was like, it was definitely my bottom. So I got into the bus and I went to my house, my apartment. And I got out and you know, I loved CJ's talk and I loved all the glamour and glory. And my drinking was pathetic. It was pathetic all the time. You know, I had fun, but it wasn't glorious. And I ended up that last, 9 months, in my apartment, drinking and looking at the door. And when someone would knock on the door, I would hold my breath. And when the mailman would come up on the porch, I would hold my breath because I didn't want anyone to know I was in there. And I would call my mother and say, "I'm going to come visit you." She lived 2 miles away, and I wouldn't go. And I know what was happening at that house. There was an empty chair, and my mother was crying, and my father was swearing. And they say in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the promises, you will not regret the past nor wish to close the door on it. Because no matter how far down the scale you've gone, you will see how your experience can help others. And I always want to say, I regret that. But I want to say it out loud tonight, today, in case it can help somebody else, in case it can help you relate to me as an alcoholic. Because the only thing that really makes me qualify for standing here is every day I would get up in that apartment and say, get a job today. Figure out what you're going to do about this pregnancy. Go see your mother. And somehow between my bedroom and the kitchen, a drink sounded like a better idea. And you who are here know that. I didn't know how to not drink, and I wanted to so badly. Every day I thought, you know, you're not drunk right now. Why don't you try to make it to the paper? You know, why don't you try to make it to outlining some jobs? And I did have one job interview that somebody set up for me. I'd stayed awake all night the night before, and I got in the shower realizing I was going to be late, and I banged my head on the shower, you know, spout, and I put a big half-moon hole in my head that I couldn't keep from bleeding. So I put this dirty shirt on and a tie, and I went to this thing with blood dripping down my nose that I kept patting and trying to sell myself. And you know how when you think, if I just don't stop talking, I'll convince them? He just sat there. I'd love to see that guy today. He just sat there and looked at me. It didn't say a word, didn't ask me a question. And then I got up and I went home and said, I think I got that job. And he never called. And the thing, you know, he may have. I didn't answer the phone, but, and I didn't answer the mail. You know how the mailbox gets more and more full and things turn red in there? And I just thought, if I don't pick those up and open them, they'll go away. And so anyway, I couldn't stop drinking. That's my drunkalogue. And now, for the remainder of the time, I hope I can tell you about what happened and what it was like now, because it's amazing. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Just around Mother's Day at that time, my mother, who was very sick, but doing pretty well, actually. They told her she had a year to live, and she said, then I don't want to do chemo. I don't want to do radiation. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to be sick. I want to enjoy my life. She lived 12 years. But at this time, we all thought she was dying, so this Mother's Day was pretty important, and I made it. I got it. I'd been awake all night. I drank. I did put on a clean shirt on a dirty body, and I went to the yacht club, which I always want to put a caveat. It was just a little place with people with boats. It was no big deal. And we went there where there was a brunch for Mother's Day, and I was sitting there looking at my family. I weighed 108 pounds. I could hardly speak and make sense, and they were staring at me like I was Uncle Ed, and it was Thanksgiving. And I recognized the look, because I was the king of that look. And I just felt so small and so stupid, and I just kept talking and making no sense. And I got in the car, and my brother, who at this time is like 12 years sober, says, you know, let me take you home. And on the way home, we got in an argument about, I don't know what it was about, but we got in an argument, and I went into my apartment, and I was so filled with righteous indignation. You know, I'm not paying my bills. I got a teenage girl who's pregnant. I don't have a job, and I'm filled with righteous indignation. I'd like to know what that was about, but I don't know what the fight was about, but I waited for him to get home, and I called him, and I just started tearing into him about everything, you know, everything. And he waited and listened, and at the end he said, "Matthew, I think you have a problem with alcohol and drugs." And I don't know why I said this. I think it was an act of God and some grace, but I said, "Of course I do." Did you think I was retarded? You know, I'm sitting at brunch going, But lots of people had said, "You need to stop drinking," and I couldn't hear them. And he said this, and then I'm from a pretty big Irish Catholic family, and he said, "Stay right there, I'll be right over." So what I thought would happen is my brother Neil would come over, he'd beat the crap out of me, and I'd stop drinking. Because that's how we did things in my family. And it was perfectly legitimate as far as I was concerned, and I sat there and prepared myself for a beating. And he came in and said, "You want to smoke? You have any cigarettes? I need to talk to you." And I took 2 packs of Marlboro Reds, and I went down to the beach, because I lived right next to the beach, and I sat in this lifeguard stand, and he talked to me in a way he had never, ever talked to me. He told me how he felt when he lived in his car, and how he felt when he got Tyann pregnant, and how he felt when he broke my parents' heart. He told me about loneliness and about this unbelievable despair. He told me how I felt. And I thought I didn't think anyone knew how I felt. And the last person I expected to know how I felt was him. And I thought, what a brilliant thing to do. What a beautiful man that he laid it out for me. He told me his story. But you know what? It's the book. It's the chapter, Working with Others. It wasn't his idea. It's how you do it. You never talk down to an alcoholic. You win their confidence. You tell them your story. You tell them how you felt. And then you listen. And we did that chapter, you know, with no book around. And I ran out of cigarettes. So I said, I smoked 2 packs of Marlboro Reds. I weighed 108 pounds. I must have just been buzzing, you know. And I said, "Okay, all right, I'll go to AA. And he goes, "AA, you're going to a hospital, man." And this is me, you know. I'm like, I can't go to a hospital. I'm busy. And I absolutely believed it. You know, I hadn't gotten off my couch for several months. I wore surgical pants. Remember that were real popular, you know, ER pants? That I never changed, you know. Yeah, it's all right. I didn't go to the bathroom much either. I was totally dehydrated. So I was too busy for rehab, you know. But really what I thought, and I don't know if you can relate to this, but I thought all the balls are going to fall. If I stop drinking, all the trouble I got in is going to hit me. All the warrants for my arrest, this baby, that mother that I owe an apology to, it's all going to happen at once. And various and sundry other things, trouble I've gotten myself into. Friends I owed thousands of dollars to. That apartment, my roommate moved to Mexico but wanted to keep the apartment, so he paid half the rent and I was supposed to send him a check. And it's just unbelievable how bad the mail is between Los Angeles and Mexico, because he never got it. And he was a really good friend of mine, but you know, it's just easy to screw people when you got lizard brain. I got to get off. I got lizard brain. If it's not about me getting loaded, I don't care about it. If you can help me get loaded, then I'm going to use you. Anyway, I said I'd go to a hospital. I just wanted my brother to leave and shut up. And I went back to my apartment, and I got loaded for a couple of days. And then I got into a car. I was about to get into a car to go to the hospital, and the phone rang, and my little daughter Phoebe was born. Yeah. So they had been trying to reach me, but I wasn't answering the phone. And I went out, and I couldn't find the car. I bought an AMC car for $200, and I couldn't find it. And then I found it, and then I went to the wrong hospital. And then that hospital said, "You know, we have a floor you may want to visit." Because I'm just like, there's a baby here. It's my baby. And so I found the right hospital. And I walked into that hospital, and I held this little baby in my arms. And she was so beautiful. And my sponsor says there's a moment of clarity when you know everything's going to be all right. I didn't have that. I had the moment the moment of bitter and incomprehensible demoralization. I felt so small. And here was this teenage girl saying, look at her, look at her. I'm so glad you came. And I just felt like the biggest piece of shit on the planet. And I thought, how could something as beautiful as this have anything to do with me? And I got in the car, and I went to the rehab. And it was the scariest day of my life. I was leaving my medicine, going to see strangers. And I went in there just terrified. I asked him for the picture from my file when I left, because he could see my whole skeleton. And I had this smile on my face like, everything's fine. It's just funny that we can do that, you know? It's like, no, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm fine. Things are good. Thanks. And so I asked for that picture, and they took the picture, and they go, hey, look at this. And they laid them side by side the day I left, and I gained 47 pounds. Yeah, and I weighed 108. I weigh 160 now. And I'm not fat. But I have to work at keeping 160. But the second scariest day was the day I left that hospital. Because now I got to go out there, you know. So I went out there into the world, and I was very afraid. My brother came and picked me up. He was at some conference in Palm Springs, and he acted like he was asleep. It was funny. He said, you drive. Like, very quickly. We got gas, and I'm talking to him. He said, you drive. And he, like, fell asleep like that. And he said later, you were so full of newcomer bullshit, man. I just couldn't listen to you. You know, he said, I'm going to change the world. I'm going to be the best dad ever. And I'm going to make mom and dad a new house. And, oh, my God, I'm sober. And, you know what? I was afraid. I was scared. And I didn't know what to do. So I told him all this crap, you know. And he just pretended to sleep. And I drove and stopped and drove. And then I get to my apartment, and he says, okay, go to a meeting. And he pushed me out of the car. And I walked into my apartment, and there was a guy snorting coke on my couch. And there was some people smoking pot in my kitchen, and somebody handed me a Coors. Not a beer, a Coors. And I looked at it, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm not bulletproof. Because all I had then was 30 days of sobriety, and I loved those 30 days. I loved my clear eyes. I loved the thought that I knew what I was thinking and saying and where I'd been. I loved all my friends from rehab, and now nobody's there but me, and I got this beer in my hand. So I put it down, and the voice in my head said, go to AA. And I walked out of that apartment. You know, all my lower companions had moved in. And I walked out, and I went to a phone booth, and I called AA. And they said, there's a meeting about two blocks from where you are. I told them the corner. And I went to that meeting, and I stood outside because I was afraid. I love it that there's a lot of people in their first year here today. I salute you. Beyond anything in my life, the hardest thing I've ever dealt with was my first year of sobriety, particularly before the steps kicked in. That's the desert. No alcohol, no recovery. And all you have is all these people to hang close to and stay in front of and stay in the middle of. You can't fall out of the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can fall out of the edge, and we do all the time. But I went to this meeting. I was so afraid to go in, I walked around the block. I walked around the block again, and I prayed my ass off. The only prayer I knew was the Serenity Prayer. I said it like a mantra, you know, and a bunch of Catholic prayers in Latin. So then I went in that I didn't know what they said. And then I went into this place, and there was a guy setting up the chairs. I was like an hour and a half early. And it was really, God was taking care of me, because the guy said, I walked in, and I said, I am so afraid. I didn't say hello. I said, I am so afraid. And his name's George O'Hagan, and he's just a wonderful man. And he said, okay, I'm going to help you. You need to set up all the rest of these chairs. And I was like, okay. And I was still very afraid. And then he stood me by the door. He introduced me to everybody, and I knew some of them. They were my brother's friends. I played volleyball with them. I played softball with them. They'd come to my parents' house and help clean up and do stuff for my mom and dad. They did AA. And I didn't hear a thing at that meeting, but I had that moment of clarity. I'm going to be okay. And my first year of sobriety is really what I was told to get a sponsor who had what you want. So at my third meeting, there was a guy who had a decent used car, and he seemed really comfortable in his skin. And I'm honest truth, I said, that guy has what I want. And I went up and said, you know, I'm Matthew, and I'm an alcoholic, and I want you to be my sponsor. And he said, okay. He said, okay, do you have a job? And I said, no. And he goes, okay, get a job. And I go, what kind of job should I get? And he said, the kind with a paycheck. I said, okay. And then he said, and meet me here tomorrow night. And I met him there. And I went to meetings all day long. I moved in with my parents, who had changed the locks on the door. This is a funny story. I came home because I couldn't live in this house. You know, there were all these drug addicts flopping there. And I went into my parents' house, and the lock, I had a key, but it didn't work. And they came out and took me in and gave me my old bedroom back. And I said, hey, the locks have changed. And they went, yeah, change the locks. Why'd you do that? And they're like, well, we found out that you were an alcoholic and a drug addict. And we've been through this before, and we wanted to keep our stuff. I said, oh. But I never stole from my parents. I stole their hearts, but I never stole their money. I stole money from people that I, you know, wasn't in my family, but like my best friend and stuff like that. But anyway, I go to these meetings, and I'm so afraid. I remember walking across the AA room meeting with a cup of coffee, just shaking, because I think you're all looking at me. The good news to the newcomer, everyone in AA is so self-centered, they're not looking at you. But I thought they were. And I just feel like I got so blessed. You know, I went to this AA where there was this meeting that I picked my sponsor at was a step study meeting. And they didn't celebrate birthdays, but they celebrated fifth steps. So if you did your fifth step, you got to stand up. And everybody applauded, and you got to talk about the experience of it. So I wanted to get there. And I went to a meeting where they did the 11th step. They prayed, and then they read other book about the 11th step, and then they meditated for 10 minutes in front of a fireplace. And then we talked about 11th step stuff only. So I had the steps were just always part of it, you know. And my sponsor was very, you know, didn't give me a lot of direction, but he just kind of would nudge me and really loving man. An interesting thing is I was so in love with my daughter, Phoebe. She was just so beautiful, and I felt like maybe I could offer her something. And I would go, and her mom was very, very cool about letting me visit. And what I did was I would work at a newspaper from midnight to 4 in the morning, and then I would sleep for a couple hours, and then I would go to an AA meeting, and then I would drive and deliver packages. And then I would go to a noon meeting, and then I'd sleep for a couple more hours, and then I'd go to a night meeting, and then I'd go to the newspaper. So I went to 3 meetings a day, and I slept about 6 hours a day, and then in between when I was delivering packages, if ever I was in Phoebe's neighborhood, I would go visit her and hold her and play with her and just be amazed and dazzled by her. Nancy really described the amazing unconditional love of this person looking up at you, you know. And unfortunately, Phoebe looks a lot like me. There's no blood tests required, and her mom is a lovely woman, but I fear for Phoebe. But she's beautiful, so beautiful to me. And I mean, she's beautiful, but she's, you know, we're going to be 11 next month, and it's just a beautiful thing to have. But she was being so loving to me, and I remember telling my sponsor, because I wanted to look good to my sponsor. I said, you know, I really, really love Phoebe, you know, I love my daughter, blah, 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 and he wouldn't say anything, and I was kind of irritated by that, and so a couple of days later, I said, oh, you know, I saw Phoebe again today, man, I love Phoebe, because you should get kudos for loving your kid. I don't know what I was thinking, but my sponsor said, Matthew, how much child support are you paying? And I go, I work at that newspaper, and then I deliver those packages, and I'm living with my folks. He said, I don't think that answered my question. I said, well, I'm not paying any. And he goes, then you're really full of shit, aren't you? He goes, this is a program of action. So I went home so red-faced and angry. But you know what? You know what kind of anger I had? It was that anger of getting caught. It was that there's no way around it. He's right. He's absolutely right. So I stayed in my room. I called Anna, who's the mother of my daughter, and I woke her up and said, Anna, I'm so sorry. I should pay you some money. And she goes, God damn right you should. And I said, oh. I guess everybody's been thinking about this. And I said, you know, I don't make very much money, but I can give you every paycheck. I'll give you a percentage of my paycheck. And she said, okay. And we talked about it. And, you know, the weird thing was I did that every 2 weeks. I got all my money together and I'd write her a check. And I didn't get a thank you note. And there was no parade. And there was no, like, it wasn't in the paper or anywhere in the paper. And but you know what? I knew that I did it. And slowly, over months and years, and I make a lot more money than I did now, and she makes the same percentage of my income, I didn't feel like a piece of shit anymore. And when people will say to me, who I sponsor, I really need to make amends to myself first, I don't talk down to them. I say, maybe if you make all the other amends, that won't be necessary. Because every amend is for ourselves. It's all about restoring ourselves. And I had to learn that. I had to have experience with that. Now, paying child support is not an amends. But you understand what I'm saying. I did what I was supposed to do, and I felt whole again. And I made amends. You know, I paid that guy back that I owed all that $15,000, that guy who I'd sort of lived off of, my best friend. And the funny thing was, is I take my watch off so I stop looking like I have a train to catch. I collect old watches, so I often don't know what time it is. But I love them. But this guy, I paid him back a little at a time. My sponsor said, you know, you write him a letter because he was far away, and you send him a little money, you know, earnest money, and you send a check every month. And I'm like, okay, I'll do that. I just didn't want to drink again. I was so afraid I was going to feel that way again. I just didn't want to do it. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And I write a check, and after about, it might as well have been $10 million, you know, $15,000, I'd never seen that much in one place, and I'd never made that much. So if I had, I'd spent it immediately. And there I was, you know, paying this guy $25 and then $50 a month and then $100 a month, and then I'd miss a month and pay him $200 or call him. And then one day, I paid him about $7,000. He called and said, hey, stop sending me that money. He said, you know, I'm so proud of you, and you just, it's so great to see you sober. And I'm just really grateful to have been a part of your life. And, you know, thank you for that, but you don't need to send me any more money. And you know what? I made the grave error of calling my sponsor. And I said, because I wanted credit for completing this. And I said, hey, you remember that guy, Larry, that I owed $15,000 to? He goes, yeah, yeah. I go, yeah, I paid him $7,000. And he called me and he said, I don't need to pay him anymore. And I'll never forget how he did this, because I wish I was this cool, you know. He goes, oh, really? He said, that's that guy you started paying back when you worked at the newspaper, huh? And then you worked on that that delivery place. And I go, yeah, I did the right thing. And then he said, yeah, and now you own your own home. And I said, yeah. And he goes, and you want to stop doing what's working? Okay, click. I was so mad, and I called this guy back. I can't stop looking at my wrist. I called this guy back, and I said, you know, I have to pay the money back. And there was this long silence. And he goes, oh, okay. And you know, when my father died eventually, my mother died, and I'd made amends to my parents, and I was holding my mother in my arms. I showed up for my mom. My sponsor told me, I had these grandiose ideas, you know, like, I'm going to bring her her favorite meal from this restaurant, or I'm going to bring roses, 2 dozen roses. And he'd say, you know, you're so grandiose. She's your mom. She just wants you to go over there and hang out. Why don't you stay an extra half hour instead of buying her all this junk? And he was so right, you know, and I got to have a relationship with her, and I got to make an amends to her. I physically and verbally, I did the whole thing, and I got to hold her in my arms when she died, telling her I loved her, and feeling just clean and free. None of that, oh my God, you can't go, we have unfinished business. It was, please go, you need to go, you're in pain. And somebody said this weekend that their vision, their relationship with God has changed. And my relationship with God changed that day. There were no angels in the room. But it became very immediate and very real and very much about love and loving. I just love that woman so much. I miss her. And then my dad died, and he left me a bunch of money. I love my dad. I took care of my dad. I showed up for him. He missed my mom. He loved her. 50 years of marriage. No infidelity. He didn't even joke about it. He was lying in his deathbed, and I was running out of things to say to him, and I said, Dad, I saw some of your old business partners. He said, what did you tell him? He's lying there with a diaper on, you know, in his house, and he goes, I said, I told him about your condition, Dad. And he waved me close, and he goes, you mean the nymphomania? He was just a really funny Irish man, you know? I miss him, too. Anyway, I got very much into the steps, and I got very much into doing this work, and I started to see these steps working for me, really working for me. And I realized when you guys said that they were tools, I didn't know what you meant. I didn't understand. They had nothing to do with my immediate issues, you know? I had warrants and stuff, and I went to jail my first year of sobriety behind warrants. You know, I got pulled over for a smoking tailpipe, and the guy said, step out of the car, please. And I said, I'm 60 days sober. And he said, welcome to your past. Turn around and put your hands behind your back. So anyway, I was sober, and I thought, you know, these are real tools. But step 11 confused me. Because this knowledge, pray only for knowledge of God's will for you and the power to carry that out. And I said to my sponsor, you know, what about that? You guys look. I said, what about that, you know? How do I know God's will for me? And he didn't answer me. He just listened as I ranted about it. And I called him again and said, you know, I'm pretty serious about this. I know these are tools for living, and I believe in this program, and I love this, but I don't get this. It's too ambiguous. And he said very quietly, he said, Matthew, God is constantly showing you his will for you. It's the next indicated thing. When the alarm clock goes off, God is whispering, get up. When the bill comes in the mail and says, pay this amount, God is saying, pay that amount. When Phoebe's diaper is dirty, God says, change it. It's the next indicated thing. And it sounds so simple, but it saved my ass when he told me that. Because I always wanted to do the fifth or sixth thing. I love it. I talked to a newcomer, I go, we do this one day at a time. He goes, as opposed to 2 days at a time. Anyway. So that really had a profound effect on me. And one day I was sitting in a meeting, and there was a guy visiting from Australia in my home group, and he said, I'm visiting from Australia. I don't really know anybody here, but I wanted to introduce myself. I'm going to visit once a month. And I was saying that prayer. It said, relieve me of the bondage of self, that I might better do thy will. So I thought, you know, maybe I should make a point of remembering that guy's name. So I did. And when he came back a month later, I kind of ambled up to him and said, hey, Kevin, welcome back. I'm Matthew. And he said, oh, you remember my name. I'm impressed with that, in this great Australian accent. And he said, what do you do for a living? And I was like, oh, shit. And I go, well, you know, I drive a truck, and then I fold newspapers at night. And I went to grad school, by the way. And he said, well, come see me. And he was like a huge executive at Qantas Airways, and he gave me a job. And the reason I say this story is I wasn't looking for a job. I was trying to be of service to an alcoholic who was out of place, and I got a job. I didn't rifle the room. I didn't hand my resumes out as the greeter. I went up to this guy and said, welcome back to the meeting. Well, because I see that sometimes in meetings. I'm like, you know, we'll help you, but let us help you. You know. Anyway, it was very funny. I went to see Kevin, and I gave him my DMV report, and he gave it to his human resources person, and I went in to interview with her, and I heard her walk back in there because I got all this stuff on my DMV. I went to jail 3 times for the same DUI. That's how lame I am. I just couldn't pay the whole fine, you know. But anyway, he goes in, and I hear her whispering to him, and then he goes, he's not going to fly the goddamn planes. He's going to put people on them. So he hired me. It was so sweet, and there I was working at Qantas Airways, and I just felt on top of the world. I had made friends with the wife, the mother of my daughter. I was not going to marry her. We realized that we were going to be clothed and sober a lot, and it wasn't going to work out. But I was, you know, she went off to Chico State, and I went and visited, and I called every single day and talked to an infant and said, hello, I'm your dad. And just, I did what I was told to do. And when she would get upset with me and scream at me, my sponsor would say, you know, it takes two people to have an argument. She has every right to be mad at you. Just let her yell and then say, excuse me, I'll talk to you when you're not so upset. And that really healed us, Anna and I. It really did help. I let her get her stuff out. It didn't push all my buttons. She threatened I'd never see Phoebe, all that stuff that we go through. But there I was at the airport, and I bought a new guitar. I was making enough money where I could pay my amends, pay my rent. Oh, no, I wasn't paying rent. I was still with my parents. And I bought this guitar. It was a beautiful guitar. It's a Taylor, Dan Curry. It's just a lovely instrument. And I was so excited, you know. And nobody at the airport, I wasn't real close with my Qantas coworkers because I got hired by the vice president. So everybody was a little nervous, and I would never go out to drink with them. But I went up to the bus stop, and there was this lovely British woman from British Airways standing there. And I was just so excited, and I said, hey, can I show you my new guitar? And she said, I don't look at strange men's guitars. And I said, oh, okay. And I said, well, why don't we talk for a minute, and then I won't be a stranger, because you can tell I'm inherently shy. And I said, we'll talk for a minute. And she's like, oh, okay. I could tell her. She was just bowled over by me. And she was reading a book called Surprised by Joy by C.S. Lewis, and I'd read it. I love to read spiritual books. I have a minor in religious studies. I love to read that stuff. Even drinking, they're very entertaining. But I got into the bus with her, and she says I looked at a ring finger. I don't remember that, but I was 30. You look at ring fingers. And we got off the bus, and I said, hey, you want to have dinner? And she was pissed. She goes, I knew that's what this was about. I'd prefer it if you didn't speak to me. And she walked off, you know. And I'm like, well, what about my guitar? The next day I'm standing at that bus stop. Oh, and I realized that I had grown spiritually because I went to work the next day and I didn't tell anyone that she was a lesbian. Because that's what I would do, you know? It's like, oh, you don't want to go out with me? There must be something different about you. But, you know, it was true. I just went to work and thought she didn't want to go out with me, and that's okay. I don't have to tear her down or paint her in a different light. I love lesbians, don't get me wrong. But anyway, she came up to me at the bus stop and said, I believe I was rude to you. Would you like to miss this bus and have coffee? And I said, yes. And we went and had coffee, and we'll be married 8 years in July. And the funny thing is, here was this woman sitting next to me with short brown hair, just lovely. She looks like Audrey Hepburn. She's just beautiful and had financially secure, not anorexic, not neurotic, not blonde, not my type. And I asked her out. You know what I mean? I was growing. I was growing spiritually. And I didn't make a move on her. I took her to ballets. I took her to concerts. I just enjoyed her. I loved being with her. I felt at home in her presence. Anywhere she was, I was at home. And she turned to me one day when I was coming home from a concert in the car, and she said, you know, you always buy me this champagne, you know, and I like that, but you don't drink it. And I go, no, I don't. And she said, why not? I said, well, I'm an alcoholic, and I go to AA. And she said, oh, and then she was quiet. And I was like, oh, shit, you know. But then I thought, if this isn't okay with her, she's not okay with me. And I was in love with her. So I said, do you know any other alcoholics? And she said, I'm Welsh. Everyone I know is an alcoholic. And that night, we were standing on her doorstep, and she wouldn't let me leave. She kept, like, talking, and it wasn't her way. She was very quiet and observant, like my mother. And I said, you know, if you say one more word, I'm just going to pick you up and carry you upstairs. And she said, one more word. And I just love my wife. I just love her. I've never, you know, we got married in Illinois on this beautiful lake, Crystal Lake, in a house that belonged to my family, and on this lawn. And I went out on that pier, and I said, thank you, God, that this is the next indicated thing. Thank you so much. Because the next indicated thing isn't all dirty diapers and checks and you know, getting up at the alarm clock. The next indicated thing can be a beautiful, moving, sublime experience. And I've had many. Many of those experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. When we talk about spirituality in Alcoholics Anonymous, I go to my office early in the morning. I have an office in my home in the backyard, and I meditate every day, and I pray, and I read spiritual books. I counted this morning. I have 7 spiritual books with me today for 2 days, and my guitar and a lot of meetings to go to, and I gambled a whole bunch, and I won. Yeah, but, you know, I read these books, and I do that prayer and meditation, and I've never once, ever once, grown spiritually during that. But when a newcomer calls, and says, can I come over? And it's like 20 minutes left in the movie. And I say, yes, please come over. Or when my sponsor says, can you do this thing for me? I can't do it. Or when I go on a panel when I don't want to, I grow spiritually. You know, I think that's his name, we were talking earlier today. It's like sometimes a guy doesn't need your advice. He needs your ears. He needs you to listen. I went on a panel once, and it was really far away, and I was the panel leader. It was up in a prison near Magic Mountain, the prison fire camp, and it was a holiday weekend, and the four other people that signed up to go didn't show up at the meeting place. And I thought, you know, no one's going to know if I don't go, and I want to go home to my wife and my children. I have beautiful children, 3 of them now. And then I thought, you know what, I have to go, you know, because this is what the men in AA told me. So I drove all the way up there, and it was getting dark, and I pulled into the camp, and it's a prison, you know, it's fairly intense. And this black guy walked up to me, and he grabbed me and said, are you the AA? And I said, yeah, I guess. And he goes, I need to talk to you. And we went and sat on this yard where they exercised, and we talked. He talked, and I listened. And it got so dark, I couldn't see him. But I couldn't stop hearing him, and I couldn't stop loving him. He just wanted to be sober with all his might, and he was tired of his life. And he is sober. He comes to my home group now. And I got back in that car, and I was high all the way home. I grew spiritually that day. That's when I grow spiritually. And I work with others in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was told to. I sponsor a lot of people. I go to a lot of meetings. I come do this. I love doing this. Although I prefer not to be the spiritual speaker. But I do these things because I love my life. I don't want anyone else's life, and I always wanted somebody else's life. I wanted Eric Clapton's life until I saw him in a meeting. And then I thought, shit, I have his life. And then, you know, I just wanted this other life. And that, to me, is my spiritual awakening, that I want my life. I have had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first time I heard someone say that, I thought they were bragging. I thought they were arrogant. What they were saying is they're professing. I've come alive here. I learned how to be a son here. I learned how to be a husband here. I learned how to be a brother. My brother, with 20 years, is drunk. My dad died, and he had no spiritual program. He had a group he went to that they didn't talk about God because you might scare the newcomer. Well, he's drunk. But this beautiful woman I married, I worked with my brother at that time. We had a business together when he started drinking again. It was right after September 11th, and we were in the air freight business, and I was the sales manager. And our business went to hell because of September 11th. So I quit because I couldn't watch him do this, and I couldn't, you know, support my family. Like I looked like the writing was on the wall. And I stood out in front of medical buildings, and I handed out my resume because I wanted to be a pharmaceutical salesman. I stood there for 8 hours a day and handed out resumes, and in 2 weeks I had the killer job. This is the guy who banged his head on the shower and sat there and babbled, you know, the blood dripping down my face. And I went there with absolutely no experience in the medical field, and I'm a successful pharmaceutical salesman. I am a drug dealer. Well, I'm getting some of that money back. Anyway, I came home, and I was so happy, you know, I was so happy I got this job, and we were finally going to be getting ahead. We've always done okay. You know, my wife had a good job at British Airways, and I was making okay money, but we had our own home, and our kids were clothed, but we were going to make real money. And my wife didn't look very good. She looked kind of tired, so I took my kids to the park. My wife had a stroke and just fell over. And her whole face just went, and her arm and her leg. And I came home from the park because my pager went off, and I thought it was this work. And I don't know who called, but I went home, and she was lying there on the floor. This beautiful woman. And she's so British. I walked up to her and said, honey, I think you had a stroke. And she said, okay, but don't call an ambulance, okay? And I called an ambulance, and I rode the ambulance, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to lose her. And we got to the hospital, and I called my sister, and I called some friends and said, I'm so scared. And they landed a helicopter, and right when they landed the helicopter, it turns out my brother hadn't paid the insurance. And they said, you know, this insurance is no good. And I said, do you have a rickshaw or something? I can take her to the hospital. And I got in this helicopter and thought, this is real, man. We're flying to another hospital because she's dying. And we got to this hospital,
And I got out, and I sat there, and I tried to help her, and they said, this is much worse than we imagined. My wife has lost the center of her brain from here to here. If you have a major stroke, you lose a quarter size of your brain, like the size of a coin. My wife dissected her carotid artery. And there was a time when I didn't know if she'd make it. I spent 10 days in ICU lying there with her. And every time I walked out in the waiting room, there were 15 to 20 people from Alcoholics Anonymous waiting there for me. What can we do for you? And I said, help me, help me. And I went back in there, and I had to go to Chicago. I had to go to Chicago, right? Because I had to go study for this job, and we just lost half our income. And you guys told me in AA, you're not special. You suit up and you show up. So I flew to Chicago with my wife in the hospital. And I didn't tell anyone at my new job that my wife had just had a stroke because I didn't want to be the guy with special needs. I wanted to be a worker among workers, like it says in the seventh step. So I went there and I studied my ass off because I had to do this. I had to be successful. And every time we had a break, it was 8 hours a day, 5 weeks of study. I'd go and I'd pick up my cell phone and there'd be 10 calls, 15 calls. We went to see your wife. Man, she looks good. You fed your kids today. We're buying a Christmas tree. What can we do? What can we do to help you? How could I drink? I was so far from home. Everybody else was drinking and ruining their marriages, I might add. You know, there was 1,000 young reps there, and they were going to the sports bar, and I was going up to my room and praying. And I need to tell you about a spiritual experience I had. I need to tell you this. I thought all my sobriety, that the serenity prayer said, God, give me the patience to put up with the stuff that I don't like. But it said, give me the serenity to accept the things that I can't change. Give me the spiritual center. Give me the peace to accept what's true in my life so I can get the fruits of my life. Give me the courage. Give me a little wisdom. It's a great prayer for alcoholics. You know, we've got no serenity, no courage, and no wisdom. It's the three vitals. So I flew home one day. I was sneaking home on the weekends because I have all these airline connections. I would just go to the airport and climb onto a plane with no luggage and go right to the hospital. And in my mind, I was making my wife healthier than she was. And, you know, I'd be gone for a week and I'd make her face better and I'd make her be able to walk and I'd make her situation less dire in my mind. And I got there one night and I looked at her lying there asleep and she looked bad. And there's all this stuff there for me to take a shower and stuff, but I just laid down and I fell asleep with her. And I woke up about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was so scared. You know, I don't live in fear anymore. I used to. I have fears. But this was like I'd never felt before sober. And I got up and thought, how am I going to do this? I've got these little children. I had a 1-year-old child. I had a 4-year-old, and Phoebe was 8. And I thought, how am I going to do this? You know, or she's 9. And I walked down the hospital corridor, and it was like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. You know, it was just impersonal light in this scary place, and shadows, and moaning people, and machines ticking and buzzing. And I felt like with every step, I'm going to just collapse. I'm going to have a nervous breakdown. I've never felt like this. The fear was imploding. And I went into the shower, and it was even worse in the shower. It was, you know, everything's orthopedic, and it's just, and I got on my knees in the shower, and I prayed with the intensity that I have never prayed with in my entire life. And I said, God, you don't need to help, like, heal her. You don't need to make me a lot of money. You just need to come into my heart, because I am so scared. I need your power. I want the knowledge of your will for me, and I need the power. And I got up, and I was just cleaner. I didn't feel any different. I just felt terrified. And I thought, shit, if that one didn't work, you know. And I put my clothes on, and every step back to her room, I thought, I've got to get my life, to get my act together. She's going to wake up, and I'm shaking. My whole body is shaking. And I thought, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm going to get fired. I'm going to lose my house. My kids are going to realize I'm a big phony. My wife's not going to love me. You know where we go. And I go into the hospital room, and it's so dark, I can't see her. So I sit down in that chair, that kind of a nice chair next to her, this leather thing. And I lean back, and I close my eyes, and I realize I could feel her with my eyes closed.
And I thought, God, I wonder if this is what the sixth sense of love. I can feel my wife in this room. And sort of academically, I thought, I wonder if I were blind and I walk into a room in a big mansion if I'd know she was there. Then I opened my eyes and I looked out the window and I saw the sky was just getting a little lighter and I saw a couple of birds go by. And it just seemed like such an ancient ritual, such a lovely thing. And I thought, God, the world is just a beautiful place. And I looked down and my wife's pale Welsh skin was just starting to come into focus and I thought, she's so beautiful. I love her so much. And there was no fear. I got some serenity to accept the things I couldn't change. And I got a little bit of courage. And I got a little bit of wisdom. And I got it all from you. Thanks for letting me share.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.